Laughing Eyes Kennel presents the Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow the Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Willow, Alaska, and on the line we have our host calling in from his home base in Tok, Alaska, the Gypsy Musher, Hugh Neff. How's it going, Hugh?
Great. Beautiful, lovely blue skies here, maybe right around 0 degrees, just perfect, spring dog mushing weather. Just ran a little 15-miler here about an hour or so ago, and it was felt nice to be, back behind a nice-looking team again. I'm looking forward to heading to Minto here soon. We're going to be racing tomorrow.
Tomorrow on a 90-mile race, I believe you said 2 45-mile heats, so not something that you've been doing for the last month or two with the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest. How's it going to be different running a real short race like that compared to the Iditarod?
Well, first off, Minto was the first race I ever did was in Minto, Minto 90. I ended up coming in third place back in the day, back in, 97, 98, somewhere in there. And Lloyd Charlie and the Rileys have always treated me very kindly throughout the years, and I unfortunately haven't been there in quite a while, close to 8 or 9 years. So to have a chance to go visit with all my friends, my Gunas down in the village, is going to be exciting for me. I'm really looking forward to it. The Tituses have been real kind to me, Jeep, just the whole village is just, it's a home away from home, and I love running the flats. It's nice and mellow terrain there, real fast, 45 miles. I'm going to have all young dogs, 2-year-olds, and they're looking good today. I'm not looking really to compete at all. I'm just looking to, have fun. And, of course, Walter will be leading the way. People are probably blown away that a 7-year-old dog can do the Quest and Iditarod and then switch over to doing a, fast 45 miles in just over probably 3.5 hours or right around there. But Walter is one of those dogs, and, he's my heart and soul. And as much as I need him, I think he needs me. And so we're pretty much inseparable at this point in time.
That's awesome, and I want to talk a little bit about Walter later on. That's going to be our featured dog this week, so we're looking forward to talking about him, how he did in the Quest and the Iditarod, and of course his upcoming off-season, including this little mid-distance or sprint race or whatever you call it. But first, let's talk about the Iditarod. I was there with you at the ceremonial start, the restart, prepping with you, getting ready to go, rocking out the hobo gym the night before. We talked about that on your last show about how you prepare for the Iditarod, and here we are about a week and a half after the race, and I'm sure your listeners are just dying to know what went on with Laughing Eyes Kennel and the dogs on the Iditarod Trail this year.
Well, I kept on telling people, even before the race, you got to be realistic in dog mushing, and I hope to do well, and believe me, if through some magic I could make a bunch of yearlings and 2-year-olds bring me across the finish line first, I'd be in heaven. But realistically, when you have 4 or 5 real young dogs in your team and mix them with a bunch of dogs that have already just run 1,000 miles, it took me a while to figure out how best to run the team. And I've tried to look back at what I could have done differently. If I had held back a little, maybe I could have moved up a few spots. But realistically, considering a lot of the dogs I had to drop were dogs that were cramping up from lack of basically a lot of dogs were being finicky with drinking, and you're not going to get your fluids in there in the warmer weather, it's going to be tough to go very fast or very far. And that's why I, after carrying I had to carry a dog basically from the gorge, Rocky, all the way I mixed him up with another dog I had to carry in the bag through, cramping up. And they're 2-year-olds that is a newer style, farther race for them that they perhaps weren't used to compared to the veterans. And that having to carry a dog in a bag really takes a lot out of a team in the long run, especially in warm weather. So that's pretty much what decided my race as far as being in the mix this year. It was tough. I should have, in reality, as usual, I'm the one that's not living up to what the dogs deserve as far as how I should have run the race. I should have had a dog, Rocky, that came into Nikolai that I carried for some 50, 60 miles from the glacier, and I should have left him in Nikolai. He was just cramped up, so I was figuring if I got some water, some electrolytes into him, possibly he'd be, you know, ready to go again. But a few miles outside of Nikolai, I actually had to put him back in the sled bag and carry him all the way to McGrath, and that was real tough because it was warm weather, and it was a disservice to my team. I should have known better, and it's something you learn from in the future. If you have dogs with issues and you've carried them for so many miles, it makes sense just to leave them at the checkpoint. Unfortunately, I was pumped up because I really wanted Rocky to be in the team because my, you know, one of my best friends, Bruce Hagstrom, every morning leading up to the race for the, you know, couple of weeks, he was playing the Eye of the Tiger, would wake me up every morning to get me pumped up for the race. So unfortunately, I had to leave Rocky behind, though, and it's a tough break, but Rock's doing good. I ran him this morning, and he'll be racing in the Minto 90. And that, if anything, was the beauty of this year's race was I have a lot of youngsters. They went quite far. You know, I had Bodie, a 28-month-old, or not 28, 22-month-old puppy that I named after my buddy Kevin Bodie. He made it all the way to Ruby, and that's pretty impressive, I thought. And had some other youngsters. Goldie did quite well. She made it all the way to Calfag, and she's just over two. So it was nice, but in reality, I wouldn't be anywhere without Walter and Annie, and we all know that, and they're the ones that, you know, got me to know them.
You know, Hugh, I was fortunate enough to be your drop dog guy and got to spend some time with them while they're here with Rocky and Bodie and Goldie and all those guys that were dropped. And man, what a great bunch of dogs you have. Even the really young guys are just awesome to hang out with. But my first question to you in regards to this year's race is it's my understanding that you got hurt yourself a little bit farther into the race this year. What happened? You hurt your leg somehow.
I blew out my left calf muscle through, again, you know, being a little dehydrated and just, I don't think people really realize what we're doing out there as far as a human being. Those dogs are running and pulling the sled, but most of the folks that are up in the mix, we're going at it with our own bodies as well, either with a ski pole or we're kicking. You know, you kick from the left, you kick from the right, you kick from the side. Some people use double ski poles, whatever you're doing. The Smith brothers are known to run for dozens of miles at a time when they're in the right mood. You know, we're part of the team. We're just another dog, and I basically taxed my body so much that I could barely even walk, getting out of Unocleat. And to get up into the where we go inside in Unocleat, you actually have to walk up a hill, and I was having problems doing that. That being said, it's not like I wanted too many people to know about my issues because the way the mushing world is with gossip these days, a cramped up muscle can turn into a broken leg within a few minutes, the way stories are told. So I just kept it on the down low as best I could, and eventually through, you know, just getting back out on the sled, I'd say I loosened up over time. And as I came down out of the Blueberry Hills into Shaktulik, the leg was starting to feel a bit better, and that's when I decided that, you know, I was going to blow through Shaktulik and go all the way to Koyuk. That was my funnest part of the race as far as being with the dogs out on the trail, is being challenged, you know. And in these races, we all face challenges sooner or later, and it's how you compete against yourself that really tests who you are in the long run.
So everybody knows that Dallas Seavey won the race, youngest guy to win the Iditarod, and he talked a lot in his interviews, as well as most mushers talk about a strategy or a schedule that they keep on the Iditarod. And I know you're not big on talking about strategy before, but I've got this question from a lot of guys, and I figure I better ask you. When you leave Willow on the starting day, do you have a particular schedule that you're going to do, a run-rest schedule, you're going to stay so many hours in this checkpoint, et cetera? And when does that start to waver at all for you as you're heading down that 975-mile trail this year?
I don't really have any of those set schedule deals. I'm not much of a mathematician and don't care to be. You know, people know me. I'm a romantic. I'm all about the spirit of the race more than the calculations and how to win the race. I don't really even care if I ever win the race. I just want to be the guy that's doing the race year in, year out. So I play everything off the weather, man. I just look at the weather. You got to read your dog's eyes, you know, see if they need another hour of shut eye or if they're ready to boogie. And as far as schedule goes, and something that might not be conducive to doing better is I'm out there doing these races. I don't want to be around a bunch of other mushers, man. I want to be on my own. That's half the reason I jump off to the front and get off on my own, is just because I want to be out there with the dogs and the land. I don't want to have to deal with headlamps behind me or deal with, you know, whatever soap operas might happen when there's more than one team on the trail. So that's part of my reasoning for getting out there. And obviously, if you're up in the front, especially in warmer weather, the trail's going to set up typically better for you. But realistically, you don't want to be up in the front because...
Yep, we lost you there for just a second, so we'll go ahead and fix that after the show. But we were talking about run-rest schedules and how you don't like to keep one on the Iditarod. And I know a lot of the big-name guys that, you know, everybody follows on the Iditarod are very particular about that. What happens to guys, at least in your opinion, if that schedule can't be kept for some reason? Say they want to stay at a, you know, run-rest schedule of 3 hours rest at every checkpoint. I know John Baker had said that, and that's one of the ways that he said he won last year. What happens if that starts to fall apart, you think?
Oh, you definitely, if you're cutting back on rest, it's going to catch up with you sooner or later. That being said, there's all different types of rest, and sometimes being in checkpoints, your dogs aren't going to rest as well as being out on the trail. And from what I could tell of Dallas, that's a lot of what the front runners were doing this year, is they're blowing through checkpoints so their dogs could rest a little bit better outside of all the media hoopla. And so I think that's definitely something that's going to be probably used more in the future. There's going to be a lot of people that are just going to get outside of these checkpoints and wait for the first team to go through and then stalk them. And it's interesting because, you know, talking with any of the old-timers, you know, we're definitely, the rest isn't what it was 10 years ago, yet the times aren't really that much different. So it's interesting to see how this race is morphing. Every year there's something different happening. That was the beauty of this year, was just seeing, you know, newer mushers up there in the front and in the lead and seeing how they played the game.
And, of course, you had a whole bunch of older mushers, old-school mushers, with Jim Lanier doing pretty well. And, of course, Dan Seavey holding up the back of the pack there. What do you think that did for this year's Iditarod, having the older guys out on the trail again?
It was awesome, you know. And Jim's, you know, the amazing dude, did both sweepstakes 25 years apart. Mr. Seavey, you know, he's one of the greatest speakers I've ever heard. I was just transfixed listening to his speeches at the banquet, and he's telling me he's got a book coming out. He's at Elam now, so he's almost made it to Nome, but you know, he's one of the originals, and he sort of looks like a boat captain, and obviously his wisdom and is shown throughout the family. I mean, just a pretty remarkable family, as are the Reddingtons and the Mackeys and what have you. But those are the true, you know, those are what Iditarod is defined upon, are those five or six old school families, and the Seavies are definitely in their prime right now. For me, you know, the old guys, and believe me, if you say old to them, they'll, you know, won't take it kindly, but the guys I like hanging out with the best, and I got a chance to this year, I got to hang out for a couple of days with Rick Swenson, a guy who I used to be so in awe of that I wouldn't even, you know, talk to. And now just to hang with him and, you know, hear his viewpoints on things is awesome. And, you know, I think everybody knows that Sonny Linder, Rick's better half, is you know, one of my heroes. And I got a cool picture with him and another guy I really respect, Joe Garney in Nome, that I'll treasure. And, you know, besides maybe Rick Mackey, those two guys have influenced my who I want to be as a dog musher more than anybody, I'd say.
So I just want to mention one more thing and get your analysis, at least on the race, from a musher's perspective, not necessarily a competitor's perspective. What do you think about the women this year and how they did, with the Allie coming in second and Dee Dee coming in 10th? What do you think's going on with the women mushers of Iditarod?
Oh, just awesome for the sport. And like I said, Allie's kennel had probably the greatest year out of anyone this year. They just did awesome in all the races. Dee Dee, I always said, is the toughest woman ever to be on the trail, just through, you know, her mark in history. Look what she's done, 30 of them. And she's just a doll, and she treats her dogs like dolls. And her team, you know, is awesome every year. She's a She's a main, one of the main ingredients in what makes Iditarod what it is these days. The women are, we as guys know that they're getting tougher by the year, and I think collectively they're all waiting for one of them to take over and be the next Susan. But, you know, there'll only ever be one Susan. So I remember in rainy past vividly, I was parked next to Allie, and I said, "How's little Susan doing this morning?" And she goes, "Nothing." She goes, "Everything about me is big." And it was pretty funny. Allie's great. She's always, she got the big Magic Johnson smile, and she's a very happy lady all the time. And Alan, her husband's one of the coolest dudes around. So it's always fun to hang out with those guys on the trail.
So let's talk a little bit about what you saw on the trail. I know when, before the show aired, we were talking about some of the things to bring up. When you left Willow, you said you jumped out there pretty much in front, and you were cruising on down the trail until things started to...
I wasn't in front necessarily, but I was up there in the lead pack.
Towards the head of the pack. I mean, you started where, 34th, I believe?
Yeah, 27th.
27th. 34th was last year, actually. So you headed
34th.
Up there.
34th, Robert, was a kid by the name of Dallas Seavey.
There you go. So anyway, you headed up to towards the front of the pack early in the race, and then, of course, there's quite a bit of snow and whatnot as you, you know, hit the trail. What did you see out there that was different than years past that caused maybe a little bit of challenge? Because a heck of a lot of guys talked about it in interviews, how the trail was much different than years past.
Oh, it was pretty smooth, actually. It was a great trail, and it was cool being in deeper snow. You felt like a mouse running through a maze some of the times, but there was always the worry of moose being on the trail and all that, but I didn't really see any issues at all, and no, it was a great trail, actually. The trail got a little bit rougher as we got towards the coast, but it's like that every year. It's always warm and fairly mellow beginning of it, Iditarod, and then as the race goes on, the weather gets tougher and tougher, and that's what makes Iditarod what it is. By the coast is when the drifted snow made it really tough on teams because it's hard to make up any time on the other teams because we're all just sort of wallowing through this, you know, fairly slow trail where the dogs can't get a nice set pace because there's always these drifts that they have to scurry around that could be, you know, 2 feet high or even higher. The beginning of the race is just sort of you want to get up towards the front and try to get towards the better trail. You don't necessarily want to be in the lead, but you definitely don't want to get caught back at where all the traffic is in the middle.
Right. And did you happen to see anything unusual in that first third of the race that you typically don't come across, you know, between, let's say, Willow and Takotna or so? Was anything any different this year than it was last?
Not really. Just trying to think back. It was a little, the ice was pretty, a little bit longer there where the glacier is outside of Rhone, and, you know, you still had a lot of bare spots in between there on the burn, but having to carry a dog, I wasn't really necessarily looking around, you know, being a tourist sightseeing. I was a little bit busy, you know, hauling an extra 50 pounds in the sled that section of trail. So it was warm, windy at times, which was nice, good air conditioning on the dogs, but you know, a lot of these years, this is my ninth Iditarod, they sort of blend together after a while. But it was a fun run, and for me, the toughest part was just getting the dogs to eat and drink. They would eat a little bit, but they're being quite finicky in the warmer weather, and it was an obstacle I had to deal with for a while.
Hugh, are you still there? Yes,
yeah.
We're still having some difficulties there. So my next question to you, Hugh, is I heard one of the guys or gals talking about when they hit the infamous section of the trail known as the burn, and they said that always the trail is just littered with runners and runner plastic and kind of looks like a sled graveyard out there. Can you describe that scenario a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, it was, a lot of you're going over dirt at times and tree roots, and you're thwacking off of burnt out forest land trees. There are the trail intermixes, but you know, Mark Norman's put a lot of work into that with the volunteers and people who have spent a lot of time fixing that trail over the last couple of years, and it's definitely getting better and better as the years within the last 3 years, he's put a lot of work into it because, you know, they had a fire there recently. So it's the beauty of the Iditarod. I ain't about to complain about trails. And, you know, you talk to any of these old-timers, you know, those boys, Joe Reddington was handing them a compass and saying, okay, you know where to, which direction to head. So I'm always thankful for any type of trail that can be put in. And Iditarod obviously puts in one of the best trails. But, yeah, it's always pretty hairy in that section. I didn't have any runner plots to come off this year, but I did in the years past. But, yeah, it's definitely a section you're glad to get through, that's for sure.
And a lot of folks prepare for that, and they ship their sleds out to the checkpoint or so right after that section of the trail. How did your old sled hold up during that, you know, that rougher part of the Iditarod Trail?
Yeah, that being said, talking about runner plastic, I did have issues with having the wrong color, and, you know, there's different colors for different types of what heat, and unfortunately I had colder colors in that section that didn't work as well if I had like a green or a red from 10 squared. Anyhow, the sled I should have, instead of sending that sled that Darren Nelson recently made for me, I should have sent that to McGrath. And then in Takotna, I could have gotten that, and that would have been a better sled to use. The God sled that I had just wasn't as good as it used to be, and definitely cost me some time. Darren Nelson sled, once I got to Unalakleet, I used that sled all the way into Nome, and it was awesome. Unfortunately, I didn't get the sled from Darren until a few days before the race, so I wasn't totally comfortable using it for that far of a stretch. But if I had, in hindsight, if I had sent Darren Nelson sled to, you know, McGrath or earlier in the race, I would have had a better chance of, you know, going at a better clip. I definitely think runner plastic and, you know, an older sled weren't conducive to me going as fast as we probably could have. But, you know, that's hindsight, and I ain't making excuses or any of that. It is what it is, and just got to move from there.
You know, you mentioned people using compasses back in the early days, and now you can use GPS and everybody's watching everybody on the internet, and of course a heck of a lot more support out there than they did in the early days in the 70s and even in early 80s. And a lot of folks got lost there on the sea ice in between, you know, right there near Koyuk or so. A lot of them guys were venturing pretty far off. I know Justin Savitas was 4 or 5 miles off of the coast there and kind of wandering around for several hours. Can you describe that for our listeners about what that's like in that section of the trail where you're out there on the ice?
Yeah, I got lost too. It had been a long day. I'd done that, what, 5-hour run or something to Shack from Unalakleet. I was behind the Boozers and Anjanette Steer. And then to go and take a, you know, half-hour break in Shack and put jackets on the dogs and get them all rebooted and everything, and then head out on the ice for another 8-hour run is tough enough. But when that end of the trail, you have an extra hour thrown on because you can't find the trail, that extra hour can be pretty tough on the dogs. And they did great, though. I got lost there, you know, about 5 miles outside of Koyuk. All of a sudden, they had a really bad freeze up this year, and there's huge icebergs, you know, that you're walling through, like these iceberg valleys, I was calling them. And you could see the lights of the village, and you're only 3-4 miles away, and you're thinking, oh, it's just right there, but you just can't figure out how to get there. And the amazing thing was, so you go up these icebergs, and then you go down into the next valley, and you're wondering where the heck the trail is. And I knew it was to the north, and so I kept on going that way until I scored some snow machine tracks, and then I just followed those, but then those didn't really go in towards town, and I finally figured it out, but it took me a while. The neat part was a lot of animal tracks out there, and I thought that was sort of cool. And just sort of checking those out, wondering what was going on, if animals were hunting each other or what have you, but big wolf tracks. Anyhow, it was dangerous. I'm not kidding you. I mean, I was sweating. I was nervous. I was thinking, my God, I can't believe I'm lost, and I'm only a few miles from a checkpoint. But you just got to stay composed and figure out, you know, you got to maybe park the team and go for a little walkabout, what is what I did, and then I figured a way out. Then I just walked back to where the team was and got the hook and figured out how to get into town. But it was dangerous in regards to me being sweaty and it being cold and hypothermia and all that. So I was a little nervous about that because you ain't no many, ain't too much wood in the middle of a bunch of icebergs to get a fire going.
So let's talk about that just for a second. I know you're a veteran of multiple, way up into the 20s now, of these 1,000-mile races, and you said you were nervous out there on the ice, and a lot of this comes to, you know, knowing the trails and doing these races so many times. How do you think that sort of thing helps or actually hurts some of these rookie guys like Justin Savaitis? Is, you know, this is only his second Iditarod. He was out there, you know, for hours. How does that? Yes. What is going through those guys' mind that don't have the experience like you do?
I don't really know the guy that well, but I was also nervous because I was worried that Martin and Roan were right behind me, you know, trailing me into Shaq. But they ended up staying in, or trailing me into Koyak. But they ended up staying in Shaq Tulloch for quite a bit. That was part of my nervous energy, like, what did I make this move for no reason at all? But it worked out in the end, so I was cool with that. As far as rookies go, you know, the smartest rookies are the ones who realize how dumb they are. That's what I always tell people. And same with veterans. You know, all these veteran guys that, you know, think they own the trail, those are the ones that, you know, I don't think tend to evolve at all. And I think as any wizened human in this world, we all realize that we also have a lot to learn. And as a rookie, you need to learn the most. So if you're smart, you'd be like me. When I did my rookie year, I just said, okay, I'm not racing this race. I'm just going to hang out with Timmy Osmar. And Timmy and I had done a bunch of quests together. So he's a big mentor of a lot of us who we miss out on the trail, at least I do. And so I just, that race, I chased him around for a while, and then he left me in the dust. And I just, you know, did the coast on my own, and that's the big difference in Iditarod in any race, is the coast of Alaska, and it tests you as a person. The land is different, the winds are different, and it's something your dogs haven't seen. So if I was going to give any advice to any rookie musher, I would say to purchase a dog or lease a dog that has been to know before and is a leader, and that'll make your life a lot easier.
There you go. That's
word of advice.
That's the advice from the Gypsy Musher, Yukon Quest champion this year, and multiple veteran of the Iditarod. So, Hugh, you mentioned we want to get into what happens after the Iditarod here in just a second, but you mentioned that you saw some animal tracks and things out there on the trail. With all of the media and all the people that follow the Iditarod from checkpoint to checkpoint, do you get a chance to see any type of wildlife out there, sands, you know, the occasional moose or whatever? Have you got a chance to really get close to nature other than just being on that trail looking forward at your dogs?
Yeah, that was the funniest part that I sort of an eye-opener for me about this race, is coming off the quest, I had, you know, lots of phone calls and lots of media wanting this or that and wanting me to do this or whatever. And then as I got into the race and I'm not in the top five mushers, all these people that had been hounding me down for interviews seemed to have disappeared. So I thought that was a bit of a wake-up call on the humans and their thirst for competition, and how the people that aren't up in the front don't matter as much. And, I actually had a lot of fun not being around the media that much this year. It was cool just to hang with the mushers and the locals. And once you're out of the top, you know, mix of mushers, the media just follows them around the whole race. So it's cool to be a little bit farther back every once in a while, where you can just enjoy the trail and, you know, what it's really all about, the spirit of what you're doing. As far as wildlife, the coolest thing I saw was outside of Yentna. I look up in a tree. I was traveling with Ramey Smith for a bit, and then he stopped, and then I looked up in the tree, and there's two eagles. And so I was thinking, oh, that's cool. And then maybe 5 miles later, I look back, and one of the eagles is chasing after the dog team. And you know how it is out there, Robert. You've seen ravens follow you around, or you follow ravens around, but to have an eagle behind you, that was really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, besides that, you know, a lot of these races with all the dog traffic on the trail and the planes and all that, the most of the animals, you know, aren't too close to the trail. So I saw more animals, you know, driving around Anchorage yesterday than I did or 2 days ago than I did on the trail. I mean, I took a right heading towards the Millennium yesterday, and there's a mother moose and her little baby sauntering across the street. And they were in the right lane, and I was in a hurry, so I made sure to sort of swerve around them. and it wasn't close to hitting him or anything, but it just shows you how Alaska is sort of goofy in that way. You know, a lot of our wild game actually lives in the cities where they're not going to get stalked by predators as much. And, you know, some years, you know, you'll see a lot of wildlife. Other years, it's going to be pretty quiet out there.
But there's plenty of wildlife in terms of people out there just acting foolish, all of the Iditarod fanatics, huh?
Yeah, and then you got that other race going on, the Iditarod Walk or whatever they call it. So you'll see guys out there with bicycles or skiing or whatever. And so it's a big celebration. And it was neat this year because I got to hang out with a lot of cool mushers, Paul Gebhardt, Michelle Phillips. Get to, you know, see Berkowitz and you know, the boys, I call them, Mike Williams and Pete Kaiser. And, you know, the Iditarod has a real bright future right now, I think. I think there's a lot of good young talent, a lot of native talent, and a lot of top girls, too. So I'm just hoping I can hang with these kids next year.
I think you'll do fine. You're definitely a competitor, and you got a heck of a dog team out there. So let's go on to,
because you know next year I'm not going to be doing the quest. So next year all my assets are going into Iditarod and a few smaller races. But it's going to be interesting to see how these veteran Iditaroders dogs do with 1,000 miles less trail mileage. I think they're going to might have a little bit more speed for me next year, which will be nice.
So speaking of that, what's coming up in the next, till it snows again? I know we still have 10 feet here in Willow, and you probably got a decent dusting there in Tok. What's going to happen in the off season with you and your dog team? I know you mentioned the Minto race coming up this weekend. Any other races before you start hitting the road with your school tours and whatnot?
Yeah, well, hopefully once I get my truck started here in a little bit, we'll be heading towards Minto. And then next weekend I'm hoping to possibly go to Tanana and visit with the Earhart's and all my friends there. And then lots of trips, going to Hawaii for a little R&R for a few days. And then I've got the school tour May through possibly the first week of June. Got lots of interest. Lots of people have already signed up. From there, I'm going to be a race marshal, believe it or not, in Australia in June. Hoping to visit with friends in Nome and Teller earlier in June, and just a lot of traveling. In between that, I'm hoping to start up some bit of a tourism here in Tok with, you know, a little show and tell. And you know how I like to, you know, talk up Iditarod and Quest and all these races. So it'll be fun to try to, you know, give a little bit back to the place where I live is the way I look at it. And Tok's a beautiful spot, and I've certainly enjoyed training here, and it's looking like it's doing well for my career as well.
And, of course, you'll do another school tour in the fall. In September, you hit another section of the U.S., so that's still going on strong. So how can people find out more about these school tours? Can they send you an email? I know you got a brand-new Facebook page. It's Hugh Neff Gypsy Musher. Just search that on Facebook. It's his brand-new fan page, so make sure you hit the like button there. How can people find out more about the school tours, and do you have any spots open?
Yeah, there are still a few open. LaughingEyesKennel@hotmail.com is another way to get a hold of me. I've got in between all my friends from Germany, or, you know, I'll be going to Germany in late September, hoping to not only promote myself, but as well the Quest. The Quest is huge in Germany. I think the Quest, if they're smart, they start taking more advantage of the German fanfare they receive. As much as I want to do well in these races, if I can leave any type of lasting mark on dog mushing, I hope it would be to promote it and make it a larger event than it is. I think long distance mushing is one of the premier, you know, endurance tests that man does on this earth, and doesn't get the recognition that the dogs or you know, Alaska deserves. I think all these races could be a lot bigger than they are, and some people might not necessarily want them to be that much bigger, but realistically, you know, there's bills to be paid, and I think it's a way to show off Alaska.
I think it's a great way to show off Alaska. I think it really helped out this year with all the social media attention that it got, good social media attention while you guys were out there. The Iditarod Trail Committee's Facebook page was awesome. There was lots of talk back and forth, all positive talk. I didn't see a lot of that negative stuff like we typically see on social media.
Speaking of positive, We haven't brought up what I told you earlier today, Robert, but I received an awesome letter yesterday from George McCaskey, I believe, the president of the Chicago Bears, dude, and basically congratulating me and talking about the spirit of Walter Payton. And he had heard and seen the video on the news in Chicago. And so when I do my school trip, you know, in May, first place I fly into is the Chicago area, and I'll be bringing Walter the dog with me, and hopefully we'll be able to reunite Walter's spirit and maybe get to see a few of the Chicago Bear players while we're there. So I'm really looking forward to showing Walter off. He's a very special dog, and you know, he's my heart and soul, really.
And that's cool, and we're going to talk about him right now, Walter, the lead dog. He's pretty much your right-hand man, so to speak, and he has been for the last year or so, of course, getting that Golden Harness Award there in the Yukon Quest for being the top lead dog. And who was the other one that got the Golden Harness, Hugh?
Juanita.
Juanita. So Walter and Juanita.
She's back in cameras now.
Got that Golden Harness Award. And I got the privilege to hang out with Walter for a couple of days when we had him here waiting for you guys to come and pick him up. And, man, he's a big dog compared to a lot of the small guys you have.
Yeah, he's an interesting story. He's probably 65-pounder, a lot bigger. And there's, you know, there's another part to the Walter story. Walter Newman was a buddy of mine who passed away, you know, last year, and his family has an incredible connection with Walter the dog. So I got to give a shout out to my buddy fan man, John Larson Johnson. He knows that, you know, Walter Newman's spirit is as big a part of Walter as Walter Payton's is. And Walter's got a lot of spirit. He's, you know, one of these dogs that half the time he looks at me like, just shut up back there. I know what I'm doing. You don't have to tell me what to do. And he's been around the block. He's done probably 7,000 or 8,000 milers at least, and he'll be, you know, on the trails with me for the rest of the spring. And just a special dog. Annie's got all the. Annie has a book about her, and Annie got her due with Iditarod in videos past. But you know, Walter was my main leader not only in the quest but the Iditarod too. And most of the time, Walter is in the lead. Annie was actually in wheel because she didn't even want anything to do with being in lead. Where Walter. He's one of those dogs where, you know, when you're hooking up in the morning, he just runs right to the front of the gang line and just sits there and waits for you to clip him in because, you know, he knows his place and he wants to be the man.
That's awesome. And, you know, we did have your friend John P. Larson Johnson. He did a show on the
Jim. Hey, I heard about these guys impersonating me.
they got some pretty good listenership out of your show while you were gone. So we did a very cool show with him. We also did one with Dawson Dolly. And if folks remember, we had some pretty cool Native American music on one of your shows that that people really liked. So the Gypsy Musher was going strong even when you were out there on the trail. We were representing you as much as we could. So you got to give them hats off for your fans out there. They were keeping it alive for sure.
Yeah, it's great. You know, I know a lot of I've seen quotes on the internet about other mushers saying how, you know, they tolerate me and how a lot of people don't like how I'm such a loudmouth and might be a little bit too arrogant or boisterous. But, you know, I think I'm doing good for a lot of people, too. And if those people want to, you know, think of me like that, that's just a sign of who they are. That's not what I'm about. And, you know, my the person that I want to, you know, carry on his ways is, you know, the original Iditarod promoter, and that was Joe Reddington. So if I can help promote the quest or Iditarod or whatever, I'm going to do what I can because, you know, it's good for everyone in the long run, even though they might get a little annoyed with me talking all the time. But I'm trying to, you know, I've had a rough history in the sport, and I'm trying to make things right.
Well, you know, let's spend just a minute or two on that. First off, you know, you are the only Iditarod guy out there that has his own weekly show, as far as I know. So that's saying something about who you're talking to. Secondly, I had the privilege of going with you just the other day to a school tour, a very small little classroom full of kids, and I cannot even describe how excited they were when you walked in the room. They all had their little pictures and jumping up and down, and just they knew exactly who you were when you walked in. Can you describe that for folks, how those kids are just lit up when you walk in the room?
Yeah, it's one of those schools that means a lot. They're handicapped children that I talk to every year in Wasilla. And their teacher, Kathy Kappa, is one of those. She was one of the volunteers in Shaktulik this year. She's moved up from Florida, great lady, and I'm always honored to go and visit her school there. And through all these schools I go to, you know, about halfway through, I do about 30 schools in May, and halfway through I'm completely exhausted. My voice is pretty fried out, but it's their spirit and their the sense of joy I can feel in them being a part of what, you know, I'm going through that really makes me happy. And often I enjoy doing these school tours more than racing, to be quite honest. It's just you bring a lot of happiness to people. And it's going to be a great tour this year, not only with Walter. We got a lot of cool new shirts and stuff that you've seen already, Robert, that are hopefully we'll have up on the internet here soon. But we got a really amazing shirt that Bruce Hagstrom designed for the Quest this year. That's it's pretty cool.
So if we can, last section of the show here, we have about 2 minutes left. Let's talk a minute or two about Bruce. What a guy. I mean, that guy flew up and back two or three times to help you out, not only in the Quest, but also Iditarod, even showed up in Nome. What in the world is going on with Bruce?
He's awesome. And, you know, Nicole, JJ, Allie, Jody Potts has been training some of my dogs. Everybody has been helping out this year. But without the core group here, the girls running the dogs while I'm traveling, or Bruce, you know, doing all the logistics, especially after the Quest, you know, my life would be even more chaotic. Bruce is the man. I've often been pretty tough on all these people, but hopefully they're having fun as well. And I think they're secretly here just because they love the dogs a lot. And that's no problem with that with me. The more people loving my dogs, the better. But, yeah, Bruce has been amazing, one of my best friends. That was the coolest part about that documentary they did on Channel 5 News in Chicago. It was one very amazing documentary, and to put his picture in there sort of capped it off for me. It's interesting, you know, because we grew up in the same town, didn't really know each other that well, had a mutual friend, and Bruce ended up being a teacher in St. Petersburg. And just Bruce is totally a part of, you know, the Mushin scene now. He loves it. And can't wait to hopefully one of these days give him a team to race with and do a smaller race.
There you go. So, Hugh, we're about out of time. We'll make sure we fix all of those technical glitches there. We'll edit those out and then re-air this show, and I'll send you over a link on your page. And make sure you tell folks on your Facebook page about that brand-new fan page, because that's where you're going to spend a lot of your time with pictures and video and products and things you have to offer. Anything else to leave the show with you?
Yeah, just a big shout-out to my friends in Nome, especially the Outwaters, who have been my host family the last few years, and all the Native friends along the way that really mean a lot to me. And that's who I'm racing for. It's not just, you know, the dogs. It's to show folks that have had fairly rough lives that, you know, don't give up. There's a way. If there's a will, there's a way, and just got to keep, you know, keep getting through the tough snow, and sooner or later the trail is going to be clear. And
there
I'm looking
go.
Forward. I'm heading out to Minato here, so it's going to be a fun weekend.
There you go. So we'll definitely talk next week here on the Gypsy Musher. We'll make sure we post those links. So there you go. That is the wrap-up show for the Gypsy Musher. We'll talk again soon. Thanks a lot, Hugh. We'll see you later, all right?
All right. Peace, man.
Take care. This is Robert Forto on behalf of the Gypsy Musher. Talk to you again later. Goodbye.